from WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, highlights from WHQR's recent luncheon featuring special guest NPR senior political correspondent Tamara Keith, co-host of the NPR Politics podcast and host of a new series, Swing Shift, which follows voters in swing states over the next 2 years. Later on today's show, we'll have Keith's question and answer session with our audience, as well as a sit-down with me here at the WHQR studios. But first, her remarks from our luncheon.
I am going to start by apologizing because this speech is not necessarily going to be an uplifting chat. Although I feel very passionately about the critical role of an independent press in a functioning democracy, thinking too hard about the state of our democracy or my industry can be pretty depressing. In fact, Americans are so politically polarized, I feel that one of the few things we may all agree on is that things are pretty broken right now. Though, of course, the various factions don't agree on what's wrong or how it can be fixed. So as part of my new role as a senior political correspondent, I am working on a new project that tracks swing voters. It's called Swing Shift, and the first two stories in the series have aired already. This series is intended to last through the 2028 election. These are people in swing states. Most of them voted for President Biden in 2020 and then voted for President Trump in 2024, though a couple swung in the other direction. And the conversations that I've had with them have been eye-opening. I asked them for one word or phrase to describe the current state of the country. Now, remember, these are all people who have voted for our current president at least once. Here are the words, and I assume you may agree with some of them. Current state of the country, self-loathing, hot mess, divided, three people said that, chaotic, two people said that, floundering, out of control, hopeless. And that's where we are. Americans are in a sour mood, and arguably we've been this way for at least the last decade. I served as NPR's White House correspondent from 2014 until about 3 weeks ago. And now I am senior political correspondent, which I'm still trying to define, but I'm still obviously very much in the political mix, but I get a little bit more time to work on stories that are more thinky, I guess you could say, stories about where the country is headed and what a post-Trump reality might look like for both political parties. Because they've both been so defined by this one person for so many years now. I've covered Congress, I covered the last 2 years of the Obama administration, covered Hillary Clinton's campaign, the entire Trump administration, the entire Biden administration, the very brief Harris campaign, and now we are in the second year of the second Trump administration. And I can say with confidence that covering the White House is like no other beat in journalism. I have flown on Air Force One more times than I can count. I have zoomed through the streets of cities around the globe as part of the president's motorcade. And I've asked questions presidents would rather not answer, everywhere from Air Force One to the Oval Office to a military cemetery in France. It's all part of the job. So one Sunday in late 2018, I got a call asking if I could come to the White House immediately. And I was still in my running clothes, but you don't say no when you get an urgent call like that. So Lululemon and all, I went to the White House. And when I got there, I went up to the press secretary's office. It was Sarah Sanders at the time. And she told me to leave my purse and cell phone outside. This was sensitive. The president would be going to Iraq, leaving late Christmas night. I would be one of 13 journalists along for that surprise trip. Wherever the president goes, there are 13 journalists on the plane. For security reasons, it had to stay quiet. I could only tell my husband and one editor, and only in person, not over the phone, not over text, not over email. The secrecy around this trip was similar to how previous White House staffs have handled surprise trips by other presidents, including George W. Bush and Barack Obama when they went to Iraq and Afghanistan. So I went home and I told my husband that we would have to postpone our family vacation for a day. Oh, and I was going to Iraq and leaving him with our two kids, who were at the time 6 years old and 8 months old. And he couldn't tell anyone what was going on, including the grandparents who were expecting us to show up. We all met on Christmas night at Joint Base Andrews. We entered through a side gate. We handed over all of our electronics and boarded Air Force One in total darkness. Normally, that iconic plane is waiting on the tarmac, but this time it was in an aircraft hangar with the shades drawn. The flight essentially took off from inside the hangar, reducing the chances that anyone would be tipped off to our secret trip. And when we landed at Al Asad Air Base in Iraq, it was totally dark once again, and we were guided by glow sticks on the tarmac to attend where the president received a national security briefing. Later, he greeted troops and delivered a rally-style speech. All told, we were only there for about 3 hours. And it was only as we were leaving that we were allowed to report that the trip had happened at all. The president came back to the press cabin on the plane after we were up in the air and thanked us for keeping it a secret and for being willing to fly into such a dangerous place with him. And in public remarks, he is still talking about how brave he was to take that trip. But in my mind, I wasn't brave. There were U.S. service members stationed there at that airbase, and I was just doing my job, which is to go where the president goes, to be the eyes and ears for the American people. And that access that I have had for the past dozen years as a member of the press pool means that I have an obligation to ask important news of the day questions and to try to get answers, which means following up and pushing for an answer, even if the president, whichever president, finds that annoying or inconvenient. And no president has uniformly liked their press coverage. Generally, they hate it. They hate us. They don't all say it out loud. But they accept that an independent press is one of the key pillars of American democracy. A free and independent press holds leaders accountable. That sunlight forces them to be better, to do better, to be able to explain their actions to the American people. Recently, during a meeting with his cabinet, I pressed President Trump on what he intended to do about the enriched uranium still in Iran. He mocked the question, but then he inexplicably apologized and said I seemed like a friendly reporter. At a time when journalists are regularly and very personally attacked by the president as fake news and enemies of the people and dumb and low IQ, it was almost unsettling for him to be nice. And I think this was based purely on my facial expression at the moment. I must have been smiling when I asked about the uranium. Even though I've been covering him for years and he has answered dozens of my questions and called on me repeatedly, I very seriously doubt that President Trump knows who I am or who I work for. And if he had asked, which he often does, who are you with, he would have been in for quite a surprise. As you all know too well, the president worked with Republicans in Congress to zero out our public funding, something that has been essential to NPR's existence since our founding 55 years ago. In recent remarks, he has talked about NPR and PBS as if we no longer exist. But that couldn't be further from the truth. Yes, public broadcasting, public media is adjusting to a new reality, and we've had some very painful layoffs in the last week or so at NPR. But we continue to thrive and report fearlessly, emboldened rather than chastened. And we are still public radio. In fact, now more than ever, your support, the public's support, allows us to do what we do. And the attack on public broadcasting does not come in isolation. We are just one example of a multi-front assault on independent media in the United States. President Trump's anti-press rhetoric has been, a long-standing feature of his political persona. Even as he regularly takes calls from reporters on his cell phone and answers questions at length, he is far more available than any of the other presidents or politicians I've covered. In the midst of a recent sit-down interview, though, Trump objected to a question from the anchor by saying, "You're horrible people, horrible people." Longtime 60 Minutes correspondent Leslie Stahl described a conversation she had with then-candidate Trump back in 2016. She asked him why he endlessly attacked the press, said, "This is getting old." This was during an informal conversation, so there isn't a recording, but she quoted him as saying, "I do it to discredit you all and demean you all, so when you write negative stories about me, no one will believe you." And in our current environment, where social media algorithms feed people completely different realities, Trump has had quite a bit of success at getting supporters to believe him over all else. But in this second term, attacks on the press aren't just name-calling. He has, in his personal capacity, sued ABC, CBS, BBC, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times because he objected to their coverage. And he has threatened others. The White House kicked the Associated Press Newswire out of the White House press pool because of an editorial decision. And the administration demanded that media outlets clear their reporting with the Department of Defense, now the Department of War, if they wanted access to the military headquarters building. They're now making spokespeople, the office where the spokespeople work in the Pentagon, a secure facility so that reporters can't get to them. The spokespeople. He has encouraged government regulators to apply pressure to news outlets and their corporate parents. This means that the full weight of the federal government is coming down on the president's perceived enemies in the press. And this comes in a larger context. Since taking office, President Trump has systematically fired the government's independent watchdogs, the inspectors general looking for waste, fraud, and abuse at federal agency, the head of the Office of Government Ethics, whose job is to prevent conflicts of interest in the executive branch, the head of the Office of Special Counsel, which exists to protect government whistleblowers look for violations of the Hatch Act. Social media companies from Twitter to TikTok are now owned and operated by the president's allies, as is CBS and soon to be CNN. The president and his allies have made fast work of controlling the means by which so many Americans get information. There's just not a lot of truly independent media out there these days. Small, family-run local newspapers are folding at an alarming rate. Local TV is being bought up by big corporations with agendas. TV networks face consolidation and corporate and political meddling, as we've all discussed with CBS, for instance. But public broadcasting is a bulwark against this erosion. We are independent. We are fact-based. We are in communities all over the country that long ago lost their local papers. I was in China recently with President Trump, and as we waited for the leaders to arrive at an event, a Chinese journalist, who I think was maybe a spy, asked me why so many American reporters were there. With Tiananmen Square right next to us, I told her, "In America, we have free speech and freedom of the press, and we take that seriously." She was recording. The importance of a free press was written into our founding documents, right there in the First Amendment of the Constitution. Thomas Jefferson is famous for saying, and I quote, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." In 1786, he wrote, "Our liberty depends on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost." A little more than a month ago, I got dressed up in a ball gown to attend the annual White House Correspondents Association dinner in Washington, D.C. It is a televised dinner to honor the work of journalists and make our case to the broader American public about the continuing need for a free and independent press in American society. A recent poll found that public approval of the press has reached a new low. Just 28% of Americans have a great deal or a fair amount of trust in newspapers, television, and radio to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly. When Gallup first began polling the public on trust in the media in the 1970s, that trust was up around 70%. So we need to tell our story. We need to work to win back trust. I'm a former president of the White House Correspondents Association, and although I have incredibly mixed feelings about the spectacle that that silly dinner has become, I approached it as an opportunity to reach people, to humanize the press, to share our passion with people who may not understand what we do, why we do it, or the rigorous professional standards that we follow. So I was in that big basement ballroom in Washington, D.C. with 2,600 other people, many of them very important, when I heard a burst of gunfire. A lot of us did. It was distant and a little hard to tell what it was in those first few seconds. Like, maybe it was just some plates falling. No, wait. There were suddenly dozens of Secret Service agents running down the center aisle. Get down. Yes, okay, so we ducked. We got under the tables. And while I was under the table, but also peeking up, because my reporter instincts continue to be stronger than my self-preservation instincts, there were Secret Service agents in tactical gear on stage aiming rifles toward the crowd, making sure that there wasn't a threat in the room. The president and vice president were cleared from the stage. Cabinet secretaries and the Speaker of the House, those in the presidential line of succession, were rapidly removed from the room by agents climbing over tables and chairs to get to them. And I had arrived at that dinner that night, filled with dread about what could happen, but my fears were mostly related to what the president might say. How he would mock the press and undermine the mission of the organization. I didn't imagine an outbreak of violence. Slowly, we got up off the floor, a little in shock, and then the journalists in the room started doing what we do. We started reporting. I went up to the front of the room and stood on the platform where the night's entertainer, a magician, was supposed to, or a mentalist? He's a mentalist. Whatever he was supposed to do, he was gonna do it on that platform. And I looked at the head table. Roles and place settings were largely untouched, like a still life painting, and I looked for blood and bullet holes. And seeing none, I was relieved. We eventually pieced together what happened. There was a gunman who ran past a security barrier one floor above the ballroom, headed toward the stairs, down to where we are. He fired on a Secret Service officer. The officer fired back. That was the rapid gunfire I heard. And the gunman was quickly tackled and arrested and now stands charged with, among other things, attempting to assassinate the president. We were all safe. He hadn't actually gotten as close as we had feared. But the evening's events have still required some processing, because a space that we thought was safe was a target. Though in this time of repeated political violence, maybe we shouldn't have been all that surprised. A news gala turned into a news story, and for all the wrong reasons. So ultimately, the dinner was called off, the president returned to the White House, and he held a press conference in the briefing room where everyone was wearing formal wear. I was not there, my colleague Deepa Shivram was there. The president's tone was conciliatory. He talked about the fact that the event was dedicated to freedom of speech. He talked about the unity he saw in the ballroom. And he insisted that the dinner must be held again. Less than 24 hours, though, he was calling us horrible people. The dinner has now been rescheduled for next month, and the president announced on Truth Social that he is coming, quote, "I don't know whether or not I will give the same rather nasty statements, at least as it concerns certain people, but we will soon find out. In any event, it will be a hot ticket." And so I have those same feelings of dread that I had before the original dinner. For the past 12 years, I have reported from a place of incredible privilege. I have been in the front row watching history unfold, sometimes playing a bit part in that history by asking the right question at the right moment. It is a huge responsibility, and I would argue that more than just about any other journalism job, White House reporters are under incredible pressure and face intense scrutiny. And they should. We should. We're reporting on the President of the United States and how his decisions affect people's lives. How we report on it can affect how the public perceives the president and his policies. In October of 2023, after the October 7th terror attack in Israel, President Biden flew to Tel Aviv, and I had the honor and responsibility of being the radio pooler for that trip. Shortly before landing, a security official came back to the press cabin on Air Force One to brief us about the security protocols on the ground. And I have been on a lot of trips, but I have never gotten a briefing quite like this. Israel was under regular rocket fire. The region was just crackling with violence and tension, and we were given instructions on what to do if there was an air raid siren, how to avoid getting separated from the president's security bubble, and we were given pins to wear on our lapels. These are known as hard pins, and they are never given to the press. The Secret Service is there to protect one man. But the president of the United States doesn't often fly into a country at war like that. Once in Tel Aviv, the motorcade pulled up to a fancy hotel with a luxurious basement conference center that also happened to double as a bomb shelter. President Biden met with Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Israeli war cabinet, and we were there in the room documenting the conversations when Biden spoke to survivors and first responders who had witnessed what happened. And then just as quickly as we arrived, we were back in the air. I wrote a story about the events of that day that would air on Morning Edition the next day, and I thought I had it done. It was written, I was ready for an edit, and then we landed in Germany for refueling. I changed into sweatpants and a t-shirt, and I took my shoes off to get ready to sleep all the way home, and then somebody came back and said, "You have a visitor coming." And there was like barely time to get my recording equipment ready before President Biden walked into the press cabin to give us an update on a call that he'd had with Egypt's leader. And we all asked the president multiple rounds of questions. He made news. I still didn't have my shoes on. So one other story I will tell you, which is just a little random, so forgive me. But part of the job is just sometimes asking the question that needs to be asked. So in September of 2020, I was part of the traveling press for a Trump campaign rally in Minnesota. And it was the kind of rally speech I have seen him give dozens of times before. And I was trying to figure out what the heck I was going to say about it on the radio the next morning when I got a text from my boss saying that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice, was dead. And she had been battling cancer, so it wasn't necessarily a surprise, but it was a big moment in this political climate. The president didn't know it yet. So he was up there giving a speech. He kept mentioning the Supreme Court, and the cheers kept getting louder and louder, but he didn't know. Normally after the speech, the president would rush back to Air Force One and the press corps wouldn't even see him board. But this time, given the news, the White House wanted to make sure we got his reaction. So they moved us, before the speech was over, to a spot right under the wing of Air Force One so we could shout questions as Trump boarded the plane. And it turns out, I was the loudest one in the traveling press corps that night. I don't know how that happens. And so I was the one that shouted loud enough for him to hear, to come over and react to the passing of Justice Ginsburg. And he responded as if it was his first time hearing the news, as if I had just broken the news to him right then. He reacted with surprise and said something gracious about her being a great person. And his answer to that question, with Tiny Dancer blaring in the background, became a meme. It is still a meme. The thing where he's like, "I'm just hearing this for the first time." That's because I asked that I made the meme. But obviously someone needed to ask the question, and it just happened to be me. I will say, though, my proudest accomplishment from that night was that I was able to feed that audio back to the rest of the press corps before Air Force One went wheels up. And it is important to know that there is no Wi-Fi for the press on Air Force One. So if that door closes before you get your report out, they're not getting it until you land. But we did it. I got the audio back to Washington. So before I close out, and then we will do questions, so you know that'll be the fun part. I would like to offer something of a prescription for what ails us, though I will readily admit that I don't have a fix for all that ails us. But we're in an era where national politics has nearly replaced sports as America's pastime, and that is not healthy for anyone. It puts people on rival teams. It fills an increasing share of people's headspace with fights that feel huge in the moment but will be forgotten within days, and then the next outrage comes along. And it means people are so exhausted, they just don't even want to turn on the news, which is both bad for the business of journalism but also bad for democracy. Trust in American institutions, not just the press, is incredibly low. And that opens people up to believe conspiracy theories or to think they can do their own research on the internet and come up with a better answer than what professional journalists are reporting. There are many people who are more than willing to trust some random person putting videos on YouTube and TikTok and calling themselves a citizen journalist than those that they malign in the mainstream media. And if people don't trust those of us who are in the accountability business, then there is less accountability. So, given this fairly depressing landscape, what can any of us do? As a journalist, I can continue to do my best to do good work, knowing that each day is an opportunity to do better journalism. And every day isn't going to be perfect. So I put one foot in front of the other, ask questions, write stories, shine light on what policy decisions in Washington mean for the rest of us. And in my new job, one goal is to do stories that allow people to better understand their fellow Americans, to see each other as complex humans and not just avatars of rage. What can you do? You're doing it right now. You are supporting real journalism. You are engaging in your community by being here. I encourage you, if there's somebody at your table that you don't know, introduce yourself. Get to know new people, learn about them and their interests. And don't give up on friends and neighbors you disagree with politically. Find another way to relate to them. When you hear an amazing story on WHQR, tell people about it. You know, like casually, like not in a preachy way, but like, wow, I just heard the most amazing thing. I just want to tell you about it. A free and independent press isn't a guarantee, but I believe that it's worth fighting for. And I believe that you agree because you are here. So thank you.
Up now, NPR senior political correspondent Tamara Keith, our guest at this year's WHQR luncheon, takes questions from our audience with WHQR board member Rob Zappel as moderator.
What do you think the news media landscape lacks the most right now, besides lacking federal funding in public media?
I think that, I'll keep this short, but I think that local in-depth reporting is something that is incredibly important and is really hard to come by. In more and more communities, there are news deserts. And, you know, just like at the federal level, sunlight is an antiseptic, it is incredibly important at the local level. And I know the station here is doing great work. I find that leaders at the local level don't always love the scrutiny, but they value it. And so I think we need more of that.
Who is the most rewarding interview experience you've had, or the most disappointing interview?
Gosh, that's a hard one. I think that my most rewarding interviews are actually with like people you would have never heard of because they're just regular, normal people. Interviewing politicians is like sort of more like a jousting exercise than a real conversation. And I just really enjoy interviews where I can learn about people and what's driving them.
Do you see the current risk of the FCC exerting editorial influence on NPR?
Well, they are certainly coming after ABC and its stations that it owns to try to punish it for having The View on television. ABC is fighting back and challenging it on First Amendment grounds. Which is... It's a positive development. Fighting back instead of settling or just rolling over is a very positive development from corporate media. I don't know that. I know that the FCC has requested information from local stations. I know that our teams are working about underwriting and some other things, but like, I think we're clean. Is my understanding, and we have always been extremely careful about how we phrase our underwriting. So I hope that goes nowhere, but we are not afraid of the FCC. However, you know, we do annual training about what words not to say, and we do run those words past lawyers on a regular basis at NPR. We're very careful, but so far, it has not been an issue that has affected us.
Given all the changes in media landscape, how do you think journalism and communications programs should change to better prepare students for careers and encourage them to pursue careers in journalism?
That is a great question. The answer is too long. But I think, first off, I absolutely believe that going into journalism is a noble career that should be encouraged, even though we also know it's a pretty tough career. I think one of the best things that schools could teach budding journalists is to teach them about the business side of journalism. Not business reporting, but on how journalism institutions can thrive and how funding works and how to run a business. Because I think ultimately the direction we are headed, I hope, is more hyper-local news, more small outlets created by young people with passion. And so I think part of that education needs to be like, how do you do this in this new environment?
What's it like to be in the room when Trump puts down a female reporter, and the room is silent in response?
Unfortunately, we don't have 2 hours. I did a conversation with Scott Detrow on All Things Considered about this yesterday, and then afterwards, I sent a note to the producers and was like, hey, let's do it again, but longer. Because I have a lot of thoughts. I think it's incredibly challenging. I think that when the president insults a journalist, it is a reflection on him. It is not a reflection on us. And I think that, you know, there could be more behind the scenes advocacy, but like, honestly, he's 80 years old. He's not going to change. Like, this is a fact of who he is. What can we do in the room? It usually isn't silent. What it usually is somebody else is shouting a completely unrelated question and allows him to change the subject. What I think we should be doing as a press corps is whoever gets called on next needs to ask the question he was dodging. Because it is, no matter who the president is, it is not our job to fight with the president. That only makes us the story. And I think that we've learned the hard way that that is not a good path for journalists. We don't want to be the story. In the moment, it's not going to work to fight with the president. The best thing we can do is hold him accountable and try to make him answer. Now, the problem right now is that the White House has exerted an incredible amount of control over who gets access to the president. So we talk about the 13-member press pool. 4 of them are photographers, so they're not going to ask questions. Another 2 are TV, camera, and sound, so they're not going to ask questions. So now we've got 7, okay, who are going to ask questions. I think that's the math. Nope, it's 8. No, whatever. I'm not going to do the math. That's not why I got into journalism. So there aren't that many people in the room who are going to be there to ask questions. Well, the White House has basically commandeered the process, and they are packing the room with people who are very favorable to the president, who will ask him things like, oh, what's your workout routine? You look so healthy. Or like, how terrible is the mainstream press, sir? Or like truly wild questions that are not really hard-hitting. And so what happens is you're in this room. There's only a few journalists who are like going to ask the hard questions. He insults one of them, and then he calls on somebody who's going to ask him about his favorite color. And so the silence is not necessarily because we don't want to say something. The silence is because it moves on so quickly in that sort of environment. And then everybody's out for themselves. And so they're asking whatever their question is. And I am advocating, obviously loudly in this room, but also anywhere I can with my colleagues, that we just have to ask the question that reporter was asking. Even if that shuts down the press conference, let's just keep asking.
After a long day of reporting, what do you do that helps you keep a positive mindset?
Politics is my job, it's not my hobby. And so I try not to think about it when I get home. I try not to think about work when I get home. I mean, like, good luck with that. Like, it keeps intruding, but I try. And I exercise, and I go running with my friends or lift weights or anything that can, you know, keep me balanced and healthy and all of that. I'm not a heavy drinker. That's not how I do it.
What advice would you give to young, aspiring female journalists?
We also don't have 2 hours for this, but the things I would say are there are going to be a lot of people who say, and like especially seasoned journalists who say, why do you want to get into journalism? It's so tough. There's going to be layoffs. Don't you want like steady pay and employment? Like, don't do it. Just don't do it. I don't know how many people were discouraging along the way. But if you believe in it and you want to tell those stories, then don't take no for an answer. Don't let the naysayers convince you, and certainly don't convince yourself that you can't do it. Just keep doing journalism. And, you know, that may mean that you're producing a podcast that like only 10 people listen to for a while, but you're getting the practice that you need. It may mean that you're freelancing. It may mean that you don't have like a steady job for a while. And that's okay, because journalism, like any skill, takes time and practice and repetitions, and the best way to do journalism is to just do journalism and just keep doing it until you rule the world or something.
If you were given the choice of either being able to fly or turning invisible, which would you choose and why?
This is great. I would definitely be invisible so that I could hear what other people are saying. Be a fly on the wall without having to be a fly.
What brings you hope in these challenging times?
I I had something that was giving me hope the other day, and now I can't remember what it was. I'll go with this. This room is giving me hope because this is crazy. There are so many people here.
Does NPR still have access to all press conferences, such as State Department, Defense, White House? Do you see a difference in the procedures?
So we definitely have access to the State Department, though Marco Rubio is basically not doing press conferences, and they're doing mostly off the record briefings with the press. But yes, we have that access. At the White House, we still have our booth in the basement and our seat in the briefing room. We have access to, you know, everything. For whatever reason, and I can't explain it, the White House has not interfered with the radio pool. They've interfered with a lot of things, but they haven't interfered with the radio pool. The second they do, we're out, but they haven't. So I'm actually shocked that we've lasted this long. But yeah, we have access to everything that you would need. At the Pentagon, I'm very confused about the situation there, but almost no one has access at this point. We turned in our Pentagon correspondents, turned in their press badges when the Pentagon put in place that policy demanding pre-clearance on stories. So does that mean we're not covering the Pentagon? Absolutely not. We are definitely still covering the Pentagon. When the front door closes, you find other ways.
With the withdrawal of the government support for public media and the collapse of CBS News, where is the news media in general headed?
That might be too big. I think that I can't tell you where we're headed. I think we're in a period of disruption. I think it's not just about the defunding and the corporate changes and all of this, but it's also about people's patterns. It's about AI disrupting even how people search for information and how people receive information. Like these, the people I've been interviewing for Swing Shift, I've been talking to them at length about where they're getting their information and where they get their news and many other questions. But they are telling me names of podcasts that they're listening to or journalists that they read, and I have to look them up because I've never heard of them before. And one of the guys was like, "Well, I just think you're in a different algorithm than I am." and I hope that we get back to a place where we have a shared set of facts and a shared identity. I do think that there is a growing backlash against AI, you know, the kids are playing hacky sack. Like, I think there is a real hunger for things that are tactile and real. And my hope is that when people are looking for something that is real, they will come to public radio where we are very real. We are real people who are, you know, with you when you're in your kitchen and in your bathroom and in your car, wherever you are listening. We don't all sound like very serious news people with big booming voices. We all sound like ourselves. And I think that I hope that when people look for authenticity, they will find us.
You always deliver the news with a smile in your voice. How do you handle disturbing stories without revealing your inner approval or disapproval?
So that's my job. And as I said before, like, politics, because I knew I wanted to be a journalist from the time I was a tiny child, I just never allowed myself to be to take politics personally. And as a result, maybe I'm dead inside, I don't know. But I'm also, you know, like, our audience doesn't all think one way. In fact, our audience is incredibly diverse, and there are a wide range of people who are listening to what we put out there. And I don't want to do something that's going to make someone turn their radio off. even if it might be really satisfying to other people who are listening.
Will there ever be an end to the Iran war?
I mean, all things end. This didn't last 4 to 6 weeks. And it's really not clear how this ends. There's not a good path. There's not a good answer. Before the war started, the Strait of Hormuz was open for free passage as an international waterway. It is now not open for free passage, and it is a bargaining chip in any effort to get to an enduring peace. And I'm not sure, the president has some real challenges. I mean, I think how it ends is he declares victory at some point, because he always does. Everything is a victory for President Trump. That's how it ends. But how does he find a way to say it's a win? I'm not as sure. Because he set out some very clear benchmarks, like Iran never having access to a nuclear weapon and getting the nuclear material out of Iran. And I mean, at one point he said he wanted unconditional surrender, which seems not like it's happening. He also talked about regime change. And so which of those things can you get? I mean, ultimately, it probably looks like some sort of negotiated settlement that includes like inspections of Iran's nuclear program and some agreements not to make a weapon. But it may ultimately look a lot like where things were 10 years ago.
Our last question for today, what do you think should the U.S. do about Iran?
Okay, well, the good news is my opinion doesn't matter. I think, let's just leave it there.
That was NPR senior political correspondent and our guest at this year's luncheon, Tamara Keith. And somewhere during a very busy day between our luncheon and a trip to the beach and her flight back home, Keith spent a little bit of time here at the WHQR studios to answer just a few more questions that I had from some of you and our fellow reporters here at HQR. Tamara Keith, thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be with you.
So you answered a lot of questions very patiently and candidly from our audience at the luncheon on Friday, which is when we're recording this. So I just have a couple of follow-ups and stuff questions I've had that people wanted me to ask you, if that's okay.
Yes.
Okay. The first is, how are you doing?
Fine. I'm happy. I'm healthy.
How is NPR doing?
That's a good question. We did just have a series of layoffs which followed people taking voluntary buyouts. It was not a drastic cut, but when anyone in our newsroom loses their job, that is traumatic for all of us. And so this is very fresh, and we are still figuring out how we're adjusting. The management is restructuring the newsroom, I think, in a way that makes some logical sense. But, you know, that's that puts us all on a slightly unsteady footing until we figure out how to adjust and adapt. NPR's leadership felt that they needed to make a pretty significant budget cut to not be in a terrible deficit. And so, yeah, we're living with the consequences of that. But they believe that we are going to be on strong footing. And we did just get a major gift of more than $100 million, which is designated to help modernize the NPR network. And, you know, one of the great challenges of this time right now is reaching new audiences and going where people are, because they aren't necessarily seeking out journalism right now. And so that investment hopefully will bring us new audiences, create a better experience for our existing audiences. And, but, you know, that's a long-term project.
Right. So here's my segue. Speaking of going to where people are.
Yes.
You have a new project that I heard about just recently, which I am fascinated by because one of the main complaints we get from NPR listeners, I mean, they're not going anywhere, but they still have things and that they want to share with us, is that they feel like they don't hear enough from average American voices on the air. They hear experts, they hear, you know, other journalists, but they don't hear themselves reflected as much. And your new project kind of addresses some of that.
I mean, it is not the only solution. I want to hear lots of voices of regular people living their lives and talking about their passions. But this project is called Swing Shift. It is a long-term project, sort of a longitudinal look at about a dozen voters from swing states who have a history of voting for candidates from both parties in this really interesting and tumultuous political moment. President Trump is termed out at the end of 2028, and the Democratic Party is trying to figure out what it is after this terrible loss that they experienced to President Trump and lost trust with so many voters with the switch up from Biden to Harris. So Democrats are trying to figure out who they are, who their voters are, how they talk to those voters. Republicans are trying to figure out what's left when Trump is gone. He has been able to knit together a coalition that it's not clear whether any other person on earth could have knit together. So there are these really big political questions. And I am talking to about a dozen voters who are experts on themselves and how they're feeling, their concerns, their passions, their what they want their leaders to do. And, you know, like already there are some themes developing, but there is just an incredible frustration with the political system. And I think that that is something that we've obviously been watching bubble up for a long time. You had the Tea Party movement. You had President Trump winning. You had President Biden in winning. You have midterms where everything's just swinging back and forth. And what that means is that voters are careening from one party to another, just trying to get someone to make things better.
And I think what I hear when I talk to that type of voter, swing voters, is that they really are searching, and they haven't just picked a team. They have the things that are bothering them, and you can never really guess ahead of time what those might be. But it's not just, I'm a lifelong Democrat, I'm a lifelong Republican. It's just a more core level of frustration.
Yeah, and a desire for someone to hear them. And, you know, a desire for political leaders to address their problems and not just the needs of, you know, their friends and powerful, you know, their powerful friends.
One thing I do know, this is planned to go through 2028, right?
Yep.
So in the meantime, the Trump administration continues to delight some people, frustrate other people. In reporting on some of the things that are going on in that political sphere, how do you kind of try to keep the car in the middle of the road? There are some voices who are making some very extreme claims. You get your Tim Snyders and your Heather Cox Richardsons, who are drawing direct lines in astute and academic ways from past incidences of fascism to what is happening now. You also have people who say there's nothing to see here. How do you try to find the way through the woods there?
You know, I think that it is important to report as clearly as possible on what the president and the administration are doing and not just what they're saying and not just what they're saying that they're doing. But yes, report on what they are doing, what they are trying to achieve, what that means for people's lives. And yes, there are historical echoes. And talking to experts about those historical echoes, but also, you know, like my view is going on the radio and shouting fascist is just going to turn off a huge part of the audience. And I think one of the biggest problems we have as a country and as a democracy is that we don't have a lot of shared experiences anymore. We don't have a lot of shared facts, even though facts are supposed to be, you know, like unimpeachable. We don't have a lot of shared information sources. We don't have a lot of shared experiences. It used to be that everyone was watching the same three TV networks and they were all watching the same show and talking about it around the water cooler. And we just don't have a lot of shared experiences anymore. I don't want to say something on air that is potentially very satisfying to one part of the audience, but that would completely turn off another part of the audience. And I'll be honest, I'm not a historian. So I don't feel like I'm qualified to make that sort of judgment. What I can do is report honestly and with clarity about what is happening, why it's happening, and whether there is a historical precedent for some of these things.
One of the questions I get from our listeners a lot is about the prognosis for the kind of journalism NPR does, which I think you just described nicely. Over the next couple of decades, when there's so many financial and political incentives to gamify or sensationalize, dumb down the news, or to shove it into one silo, or to cram it into a 30-second TikTok, how does, as some people describe David Folkenflik, relentlessly reasonable journalism survive?
Well, I mean, sometimes we probably will have to cram it into a 30-second TikTok, but then also do the 5-minute story and the 10-minute conversation.
So not just the TikTok.
Not just the TikTok.
Okay.
But I think we do need to find people where they are, wherever they are, and try to inject our form of journalism into that format. We're obviously not going to change the format. But, you know, we had an old NPR CEO who once said, radio isn't going anywhere. It's going everywhere. I think, well, now I am misquoting. But basically, radio isn't going away. It's just going everywhere. We are going to different places. We have podcasts. We have little clips. Like, you know, all of these things are ways to reach people who are interested in this this sort of reporting. And what I would say is that I think people are seeking depth. I think people are seeking reasonableness. I think that some people eventually get pretty tired of every time there's a break. You know, every time we're about to go to commercial, some new tease is there to tell you that, you know, democracy depends on you staying tuned through these vitamin commercials. You know, like not everything is an urgent crisis. When there is an urgent crisis, we're there for that, too.
The last question I have from audience members and from me, too, if I'm honest, is we have watched a number of news outlets in various ways start to embrace AI. Whether that is automatically generated subheads or entirely large language model assembled counter opinion pieces. There are so many wonderful examples that I'm sure you're familiar with. As a journalist, how does this strike you?
I really believe that people want journalists. They want someone to hold accountable. You can't hold an AI or a large language model accountable for what they produce. And really, all of that stuff is derivative off of what we do. Without us, that doesn't exist. Or it's just hallucinated. So in terms of at NPR, we sometimes have used AI as a journalism tool. That is to filter a huge amount of data, for instance, or to search the web for events that candidates are holding in these 8 states that we're following. What we are not using it to do is generate content. There have been some experiments with maybe converting newscast spots into stories for the web using AI. Those were not successful. You know, like, nuance matters. People are coming to us because we understand the nuance. Like, every story I do involves a huge amount of reporting. It involves a huge amount of talking to experts and making sure I understand the issue so I can then distill it down into that 3.5 minutes. But there's so much work and so much effort underlying all of that. And people expect us to do that work.
During the luncheon, you were talking about, you know, being cautious with language and caring about language and sometimes sending that language to a lawyer. And one of the things we've noticed with AI is that it can be pretty good at some things, but there's always a hallucination to some extent. And when you've got 3 minutes to tell a story about Gaza or Ukraine or the war in Iran or trans rights or anything else where a single word choice could have Kelly McBride calling you, asking you why you chose that word. That seems to me like the one of the biggest liabilities is that the incentives behind the good enough overlooks the last yard the journalists and editors and fact checkers have to go. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And good enough is not good enough.
Well, I think you could put that on my tombstone. That's good. I'm going to leave it there because you are here in Wilmington and we would all feel very sad if you did not get to see the beach, which is where we're sending you now. So thank you so much for your time.
I'm glad to be here.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to our guest, NPR senior political correspondent Tamara Keith, and to WHQR's program director, Ken Campbell, for recording and technical support. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.